first Sunday of Advent, and we will be spending our Advent season working our way through the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth in the Bible. If you open up your Bibles, you should turn them to the book of Ruth right now. Ruth is right before 1 Samuel and right after Judges. So it's this little tiny four-chapter book, and we're going to take it out in 4 weeks. This will be tough on me to do a chapter a week. That's, as most of you know, that's way more material than I'm used to doing. So we're going to survey the book of Ruth, and the reason that we're doing that is multiple, but ultimately, this is a story of redemption, and it foreshadows the life of Jesus, the ultimate redeemer for all of us that are here in the room and for all of us in the world. And so as we celebrate the coming of Jesus Christ, as we begin to anticipate that, as we, I know some of you have not eaten since Thursday and you're still full, right? You just got done celebrating Thanksgiving. But if you've been out in the community at all, you've already heard all the Christmas music playing. I've noticed some of the homes in the local community already have their Christmas decorations up. The turkey had not cooled, and people were already putting up Christmas trees. I've seen the tree lots that are out there. People in our whole culture are anticipating Christmas. Our entire stage set, thank you, by the way, to the Ungers for coordinating this. Our whole stage set has been reset. You can just thank him personally, too. And I love, you know, Emmanuel, God with us. This is the picture of the Advent season. And as we begin to head towards Christmas, you know and I know what's going to happen. When December hits, if not for you guys, but for you ladies, you're going to think to yourself, do I have all the Christmas gifts done? Do I have all my stuff? Do I are the Christmas cards out and that kind of thing? Guys, that happens to them on the 24th. So we begin to lock in on we should probably buy something for the wife and that kind of thing. But as we head into this month, it's going to get busier and more frantic. There will be Christmas parties to attend, and there will be fudge to make, and there will be food to eat, and there will be things to do, and it begins to move so fast that we can miss the purpose, that we can miss our focus. And so right away coming out of Thanksgiving, as our culture makes this shift, we also shift to these 4 weeks of concentrating on the coming of Jesus Christ. And to do that, we are going to take a look at the probably what I think is the preeminent foreshadowing of that story in the Old Testament. And it's just this little book that is tucked in between Judges and 1 Samuel, and it's the book of Ruth. And so if you haven't opened your Bibles there, you should do that now to the book of Ruth and take out your outlines. The book of Ruth, now I have, you know, you guys know me. I feel like I need to share with you the setting and the context of this story, because if you can understand that, you'll get it a lot better. So the story of Ruth occurred during the days the judges governed. Look at it in Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. Now, it came about in the days when the judges governed, or the judges ruled in the ESV, that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. Now, there's all kinds of information right there that, unless you're like me and you're really geeky, you don't really understand. It's just a bunch of names and locations and stuff like that. And unless we were talking about Southern California, you wouldn't really get what it's talking about. So I'm going to break it down for you because I think some of that stuff is important. These are the days when the judges govern. Now, pull out your timeline. We have the time. Do we have it? Are we even going to bother? We have it to put up on the screen. It's totally useless on the screen. So that's why you have it in your outlines. On the screen, it looks like it's, you know, this big. So if you'd pull out your timeline that's in your worship guides, okay, it's on the back of the map. Oh, good, good. Does that help up there on the screen? I figured it would. I want you to just look. On your outlines, there are two white lines that kind of go down right through the middle. That's the period of the judges. If you look to the left of the first white line, you'll see Joshua and Caleb there. When Joshua dies, the period of the judges begins. And the period of the judges ends when the monarchy begins, when Saul becomes king. So we are in that tweener time. We're in between Joshua. Now, Joshua is the guy that follows Moses, you'll remember, okay? And we've been studying Moses. So Moses, then Joshua and Caleb, and then the period of the judges, and then we get into the monarchy, and the kingdom is united. Eventually, the kingdom will become divided, and then it'll be split up and taken into exile, and then they'll come back from exile, and then Jesus comes. So that kind of gives you an overall view of the history that we're dealing with. We are in the period of the judges, and if you look right about at 1150 BC, and you come straight down, you'll see Ruth. And so that's the period of time that we are involved with. So we're way past Joshua, and we're almost to King Saul. We're almost to the monarchy. That's the period where the judges ruled Israel. God worked through his judges in Israel. Ruth probably lived around the time of Gideon and Samson. Some of you know the stories of Gideon and Samson. She probably lived right around that same time period. The Bible is not written chronologically sometimes we think, oh, it starts in Genesis and ends in Revelation. There's a chronology to it. It jumps around quite a bit, particularly in the Old Testament. The stories overlap and interlay, and some of them are set in the north, and some of them are set in the south, and that kind of thing. And so Ruth's story exists right around the same time as Gideon and Samson. Now, the time of the judges was marked by extreme rebellion. Number one, letter B. Extreme rebellion, violence, death, really wild stories of people dying, and anarchy. In fact, if you have got your Bibles open to the book of Ruth, just turn back one page, or just look to the very last verse of the previous book in Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That is a great description of the period of the judges. Everybody did what they felt like. They just did what was right in their own eyes. If you thought it was right, you went ahead and did it. If I thought it was right, I went ahead and did it. What does that sound like to you? It sounds like today, doesn't it? Where if it's true to you, then it's okay with me. I'm not gonna say anything to you that might offend you because you believe that something is true. You do what's right in your eyes, and I'll do what's right in my eyes, and we're not going to pay any attention to God, who has determined what is truly righteous. We're not going to submit ourselves even to the concept that God holds us responsible for something called righteousness, which isn't defined by me, it's defined by Him. That was the period of the judges. And do you note how Israel felt about this period of anarchy, this period of violence? What's the first phrase in that verse? In those days, there was no king in Israel. That's how they felt. They felt like there's anarchy because of why? There's no king. There's anarchy and there's violence because we have no king. Did Israel have a king? Yes, they did. And who was that king? It was God. God had released them from Egypt. God had delivered them into the land. God had been their victor in military battles. God had established himself. Joshua said those immortal words, "As for me and my house, we're going to stand for God. We're throwing our lot in with the Lord." And what did the nation of Israel do? "We're going to do what is right in our own eyes." And so they walked away. The time of the judges is marked by these things. The time of Israel's judges, I'm back in the outline, letter B. The time of Israel's judges progressed in an increasingly downward cycle. In fact, they're called the cycles of the judges. When the judges first start, any story of the judges, things start on an upbeat. It's like things are going good, we've got a new judge, and then that judge takes a nosedive. And it just goes down. It's like this cycle. Like, picture a toilet bowl. That's the kind of cycle we're talking about. A downward spiral. which led Israel further and further away from their covenant with God. In fact, I wouldn't even say led. I would say took. I mean, I did say led. I wrote this. But I would cross out led and put took in there. It just took Israel further and further away from their covenant with God. It was into the midst of this environment, one that was begging for strong leadership. You remember that "we want a king" thing? That the story of Ruth was written. I think it's telling that Israel's response to everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes is a king. They wanted, and if you turn your to the next page, letter C, God's chosen people felt that their spiritual problems needed political answers. I hear this to this very day. If the president of the United States was just a born-again Christian like I am, then our nation would honor God and things would be better. Now, I'm not saying that having political leaders that are Christians wouldn't be a great thing. But I am saying that when we begin to look for spiritual, if we have spiritual problems, if our nation has a spiritually corrupt condition, and we're looking to politicians to solve that condition, we're no different than Israel. We're just complaining that our king isn't quite good enough. Because do you have a king? Yes, you do. Yes, I do. I have a king, and he's not the man that sits in the White House. It's not the person that governs the state of California. It's not those that are in political power over me. I am certainly submissive to them. However, my king is God, and I march to his orders, and I'm part of his kingdom. God's chosen people felt that their spiritual problems need political answers, but the book of Ruth, and it's inserted right in the middle of this chaos, right before we get into the judges, right before we get into the period, right before Saul is anointed king, and right after this period of the judges, and it's set right in the midst of that, it reveals our deepest needs. I think you will relate to what Naomi and Ruth and others in the book are dealing with. And it deals with God's great pleasure in providing for his people. You will see God as the great Redeemer. And I hope you will take it personally. Because that's how God means it. This book is no mistake. So, we jump back into verse 1. It came about in those days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land. It's ironic that there was a famine in the land because the name of the city that the main character, one of the main characters at the beginning of the story, Elimelech, it's his family that we're going to be talking about throughout this book. Elimelech lived in a place called Bethlehem. Now, I write down here, I can't believe I did this. You'll note on your outline, it says, because of a famine in the land of Israel, Elimelech, God is king, that's what his name means, I'll get back to that, of Bethlehem, which it says city of bread, cross out city. It means house of bread. I don't know why I wrote that. It must have been late. It means house of bread. That's not going to matter to most of you, but it matters to me. All right, so do it. All right, right now. Cross out city and write house. If my Hebrew teacher was here right now, I would be getting an F. Bethlehem, bayit means house. Lechem means bread. It means house of bread. And what's going on in the house of bread? There's no bread. Bethlehem has no bread. Okay, that's supposed to be an irony. I know you're all dazzled right now by the irony that is present in the text. There was a famine in Bethlehem, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and two sons. The name of that man was, verse 2, Elimelech. Elimelech means God is king. El is the word, the Hebrew word for God, and Melech is king. So God is king. And the name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Ephrathites of Bethlehem and Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Let me just break some of that down because there's a lot of names being thrown around and it's kind of confusing. And it will help if you will pull out this map of the 12 tribes of Israel. After Joshua occupies the land is divided up into the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is how the land was divided. I'm not going to go into that story, but just suffice it to say that this is how the land was divided. If you go right to the kind of the lower middle of this map, you will see Jerusalem. It's just barely tucked into the tribe of Benjamin. Okay? Just barely tucked into the tribe of Benjamin. 5.5 miles or so south of Jerusalem is the city of Bethlehem. Bethlehem is super, super tiny. It's a very small settlement. Like, don't think of it in terms of like Long Beach. And try not to think of it even in terms of Jesus' time. That's going to be like, that's 1,000 years later. So Bethlehem was, you know, like a thriving metropolis comparatively. And it was only probably, you know, 20,000 people during the time of Christ. We're talking, it is a podunk, you know, don't blink, you might miss it kind of place. Okay? Like when you're on your way to Vegas and you go through all those B cities out there, Barstow, Blythe, and all that kind of stuff. It's like one of those little places where you say to everyone in the car, why would anybody stop here? Why does anybody live here? It's literally 5.5 miles from Jerusalem. Why did anybody want to be there? They just didn't want to be in the big city, I guess. And so they moved to the outskirts, and that's Bethlehem. It's just this little tiny place. It's in the tribe of Judah's territory. Now, I want you to look down here because this is important. It's in the tribe of Judah's territory. If you look in your outlines, you can actually see Bethlehem on the map a little bit more clearly in your outline because it's a blown up section. Bethlehem isn't even big enough to make this map of the 12 tribes. It's that small. But they put it on the smaller map because it shows the migration that Elimelech took his family down into Moab. But Bethlehem is in the tribe of Judah. Now, that's really important. There's a prophecy about the tribe of Judah. Do you know who comes from the tribe of Judah? The Messiah is going to come from the tribe of Judah. And so all the cities that exist in the tribe of Judah have a special significance because potentially they're going to be the cities where the Messiah is going to come from. And at this point in history, we don't know which city it's going to be. We're going to find out later. It's Bethlehem. But at this point in history, we don't know that yet. All we know is that little tiny podunk speed bump on the road, Bethlehem, is 5.5 or so miles south of Jerusalem in Judah. Now, Jerusalem's up in the tribe of Benjamin. But look what it says in the verse. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife Naomi, 2 sons, blah, blah, blah. They were Ephrathites of Bethlehem. Now, it would make sense. You would look to the north of Jerusalem and see Ephraim. That's another tribe. There's another son. And you'd think, oh, they were Ephrathites. They were from the north, living in the south, and stirring around the Jerusalem area. But in fact, okay, in fact, Ephrath is just a clan. It is like a family name. Now here, I will relate this for you, okay? I'll put it in language that you can understand. Israel is a country like the United States of America is a country, all right? So when you see Israel mentioned in the story, you'll know exactly what that means. It's a country, just like the USA. Judah, that section that's Judah down there, is like a state. It's like California. Judah is like the state of California. So they lived in the state of Judah, all right? And in the Bible, it's just called the tribe of Judah. It's not like they GPSed the boundary line either. This is just generally what we, you know, what we think it is. We know where some of the cities are, and so they just draw squiggly lines between them. And that's basically the tribe of Judah. And then Bethlehem is like a city in the state of California, like Los Alamitos, okay? Los Alamitos is a city that is inside of the state of California. But inside of Los Alamitos, there's a special clan, an aristocratic clan called Rossmore. That's like the Ephrathites, okay? They were a particularly rich clan, and they all lived with each other, just like the Rossmorons, okay? What? The Rossmorons lived together, and the Ephrathites kind of lived together, and that's important, all right? They were a clan that lived inside of the city of Bethlehem, which is inside of the state of Judah, which is contained in the country of Israel. Now, that's going to be important for us because we're going to talk about family a lot as we work our way through Ruth. And the family, the clan that we're talking about here, are the Ephrathites, and they're like the Ross Morons, and some of you know them, and you know, you see the little R's on the back of their cars, those snobby little R's, and so you can, I'm playing with Linda right now, that's all. That kind of gives you an idea of Ephrath. It has nothing to do with the tribe or the state of Ephraim. This is a separate, like a family name that's down in the south, and they're from the tribe of Judah. So Elimelech, who is from the tribe of Judah, from the town of Bethlehem, relocates his family from Israel to the foreign country of Moab with his wife, Naomi, and his two sons. I was talking to Micah Lemon this morning. He pointed out that he observed that this was probably, on Elimelech's part, a lack of faith in God's provision. That there's actually a tone here that Elimelech just felt like God's not providing. And he took his family into a foreign country that was an enemy of God. In fact, it says that he went, in your Bibles it'll say, a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn. It literally means that he went to become a resident alien in a foreign country. He went to become a foreigner in a foreign land that was hostile to the things of God. I think there's some good thinking to that. I think there's some quality in what Micah shared with me this morning. Moab is just that little country that is right to the right of the Dead Sea. It's foreign territory. It was not part of Israel. It was filled with the Moabites. It bordered the land of Israel, and because of its geographic location on the eastern part of the Dead Sea, it was protected from severe famine, unlike Jerusalem and Bethlehem, which had a large open plain that led up to it. And so it was more exposed, and it would experience famine that was a little bit more extreme. And so Elimelech takes his family down into Moab. They probably settled, letter C, top of the next page, probably settled up in the north. That's where we find, in modern excavations, that's where we find most of the settlements. But the text doesn't say, and it doesn't really matter. The text simply emphasizes that Elimelech and his family were aliens. They were foreigners. They were sojourners. They were people that did not belong in that foreign country, where the pressure in that foreign country would have been to assimilate into the local customs, religion, and community. And it would have been intense. You can imagine, if you move to a foreign country, it just makes sense that you begin to take on some of the customs of that foreign country, and it's complete. I have a friend that works at Starbucks. Her name's Sarah. She's just a little bit older than I am. She's a barista down at Palo Verde and Stearns. And she's from England, and I was talking to her this morning, and I asked her if she celebrated Thanksgiving. You know, that's a very American holiday. The English don't celebrate Thanksgiving with us. They're not real excited about the whole pilgrim story and that kind of thing. And so I asked her, I said, you know, you're from England, and did you celebrate Thanksgiving? And she said, yes, we celebrated Thanksgiving, but we refused to be thankful about it. That was funny. You know, she's in a foreign country, and she's participating in some of the ceremony that exists in this country, but she's resisting being a total, like, buy-in to what goes on because, you know, she's not from here. And that would have been the same kind of pressure that Elimelech and his family were facing. And then suddenly, in the midst of this, and I give some geek notes down here, some background geek notes. For those of you that are really into that stuff, you can read a little bit more about the religion of Chemosh. Suffice it to say that in Moab, one of the ways that they worshiped their god before they were going to go out into a military victory was they would take some of their children and they would push them through fire and burn them to death as a sacrifice to the god Chemosh. And so it was a horrible. They were into infant sacrifice. The two, you know, Molech is a Canaanite god, and Chemosh is a Moabite god, and they both participated in child sacrifice, and just disgusting and evil. And this is the location. This is where Elimelech takes his family, is into the midst of that. Chemosh and the northern area of Moab was had a giant altar built and a giant temple built to Chemosh, and it was pretty evil stuff that he was living in the midst of. So when I say that they were pressured into assimilating into the local community with its religion and everything else, that would have been pretty powerful. It would have been intense. They were foreigners in a foreign land that was enemies of God, that God had already warned, you're not supposed to have relationships with them. And there's Elimelech in the midst of it. And just as it gets there, the story takes a turn for the worse. Verse 3, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. Verse 4, the name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Letter E, sadly, Elimelech dies in Moab, leaving Naomi a widow with her two sons, who almost immediately, it sounds like in the text, marry Moabite women. We're not sure if that was because they were trying to, you know, their father didn't approve of it or whatnot, but clearly they married just as soon as dad was gone. And those two ladies are named Orpah and Ruth. And the family of Elimelech seems to live in relative stability in Moab for the next 10 years. But suddenly, just as it seems that there is some stability, just as it says they were there for about 10 years, tragedy strikes. So verse 5, then both Mahlon and Chilion die. And the woman was bereft, Naomi, was bereft of her two children and her husband. She came into Moab with a husband and two sons. And then those sons marry, so she has two daughters-in-law, but her husband and her two boys die. And she is left with nothing. You got to understand, in the ancient Near East, in this culture, a woman just didn't like go out and say, hey, you know, can I get a secretarial job? A woman didn't just go out and grab a job and start working and making her own pay. That wasn't allowed. It was a total patriarchal society, totally run by men. Women had no rights. They couldn't own stuff. You were out of luck. They are foreigners in a foreign land, and they're not connected anymore to any men. They are destitute. They have nothing. We're looking at the emptying out, literally, of Naomi's whole life. They are left as widows in the midst of Moab. Flip over your outlines to number 3, letter A. In the face of this tragedy, Naomi and her fellow daughter-in-law widows hurriedly depart from Moab. It perhaps is even an indication of their destitution, their poverty, that the text jumps so quickly. It literally says she got up right then and there. As soon as those boys died, she got up with her daughters-in-law, verse 6, that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. You should underline food. It actually is the word bread. It's actually lechem. Back in Bethlehem, the house of bread, the bread had been returned. And so she had heard that God had visited his people, his chosen people, and he had given them food once again. So they jump up and they immediately head out to return. Now, I know this is another example of me mindlessly writing something. It says they return to the southern kingdom of Judah. I'm 200 years too quick on that comment. What I meant was the southern tribe of Judah. Cross out kingdom. I know you don't care, all right? I get it. Just write it for me, okay? Southern tribe of Judah. The southern kingdom of Judah has a different meaning that doesn't make any sense for another 200 years. But I'm just talking about the southern tribe of Judah. They're going back to Bethlehem, basically, where God has provided bread once again. So she departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on their way to return to the land of Judah. Verse 8, and Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead, their dead husbands, and with me, her dead sons, their dead husbands, and with me. So on the way back, letter B, to Bethlehem, Naomi asked Orpah and Ruth to go back. Go back to your families of your deceased husbands in Moab. Just go back. Your life will be better there. The scene is emotional and intense. Look at it in verse 9. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept. This is more common in the Middle East, where there's a lot of outward expressions of emotion and crying and wailing. And when there's significant departures, just that crying out and that screaming out to God. And this is the picture, is these three women are out there on the road, and Naomi says, go home. You need to go. You're going to have better peace in your own families. And these three women are just wailing and crying with each other. I know that women are not as emotional here in the United States, except in my home. And so, oh, easy. Golly, some of you are like, oh, ouch, that hurt. No, you know what I mean. Women are uniquely emotional, are they not? Men are oftentimes unemotional. Not always. I know some of you guys out there are faucets, but for the most part, guys oftentimes don't cry at the same things that women do. And so these three women, bereft of men, they're a mess. The picture on the side of the road is just that Naomi's like, I can't deal with having you guys here anymore. Just go home. It'll be better for you there. And they hug each other, and they're crying, and it's just this gigantic emotional scene. Both women, though, refuse. Look at it, verse 10. Orpah and Ruth say to her, no, we will surely return with you to your people. So Naomi presses the issue, and she frees them from any responsibility to her. We pick it up in verses 11 through the beginning of 13. But Naomi said, return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Now, I want you to note here that they saw everything through the lens of family. Like in our culture, if a young woman were to lose her husband to death, many of us would say, well, maybe she will remarry. Maybe she will still find joy. Maybe she will still find a husband, or maybe she will be perfectly happy on her own. We have a totally different culture than this one. In this culture, when someone died like that, it was the family's responsibility to pick up the pieces. If there was a brother, it was his responsibility to carry on the family name of his older brother. And so if he was not married, it was oftentimes his responsibility to marry the widow. Take her under his wing, have children, and the children would be named for his older brother. They wouldn't even be his own. It was a totally different kind of setup, totally different kind of culture. They see things in terms of family. Look at what Naomi says. Why should you go with me? Do I still have sons that they may be your husbands? She's like, I'm out. I'm done. I got no more sons. And even if I did, verse 11. No, I'm sorry, verse 12. Return, my daughters. Go. I'm too old to have a husband. I'm not going to get remarried. And if I said I had hope in that, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Now we've gotten into icky, right? Because that's just gross. Are you just going to wait for them? Like they're going to be their future husband's babysitter or something like that? That's just weird. Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has gone up against me. And I think we get that. There isn't a one of us in this room that hasn't experienced tragedy that does not ask themselves that question right there. Why has God done this thing to me? The hand of God is against me. I sat in with Juliet Palamaki and Cindy May yesterday in the hospital room while Alyssa was going through all of her testing over at UCLA. And you know, they found that she does have encephalitis again. And it's just devastating. It's devastating. I mean, I'm not even going to go through all. It's just devastating. And the first question I ask myself is like, why, God? Why? The girl's had cancer. She's had encephalitis. She's been blinded by it. She's had 35% of her brain removed. Just this last week, she had 72 staples removed from her head yesterday. This is crazy. Do we not ask ourselves, how much more can she handle? Do we not ask ourselves, why God, are you allowing this? Are we not all praying for Alyssa's healing? Are we not all right in the teeth of what Naomi speaks of here? We had Josh and Megan over last night for dinner. It's 1 year ago yesterday that Ella died. Are we not in the midst, right here in our own church family, of the difficulty of not understanding what God is up to? See, when I talk about Advent and anticipating the coming of Christ, and we light a candle and we sing Light of the World, that's not some abstract, like, oh, that's a great song. I love singing that. It's the truth. We live in a dark, dark place where Satan wants to literally eat your kids, whether they're in perfect health or they're in very, very tenuous bad health. God wants to chew up people and spit them, or I'm sorry, Satan wants to chew up people. Got all twisted there. Satan wants to chew up people and spit them out. And we sit here and we ask ourselves, why is the hand of God against me? Why is God allowing this? It rocks our faith. And so Naomi just says, look, the road that I need to walk, letter D, only I'm responsible. I'm the only one that needs to walk this road. She immediately isolates, which often many of us do we not? When we get into like real big, heavy-duty water, what do? Everybody stay away from me. We're like Jonah on the boat, right? You know, like, just throw me overboard, I'll be fine. We isolate. She notes that God's hand is against her, causing the women to do what? I don't understand this entirely, but they lifted, verse 14, they lifted up their voices and they wept again. This is just ladies doing lady things, you know. Guys, you'll never see this in Scripture. Like, men, like, don't get bad news and just start wailing again. We already cried earlier. We don't need to cry again. So they start crying. These women, it's an emotionally intense scene that's going on. They burst out wailing. But in light of Naomi's appeal, in light of what she has said, in light of the logic and the abundant truth in what she has shared, Orpah, it says, kisses Naomi. They lifted up their voices and they wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. That's a kiss goodbye from Orpah. Orpah's going back home. That's what that means. She has kissed her goodbye, and she is headed back to her family. So Orpah kisses Naomi goodbye and returns home, but Ruth clings desperately to Naomi, and she does not let her go. And now we begin to learn about Ruth. This is the first time Ruth will speak in the book. So that's significant. Whenever you see a main character speak, you know, first time, that's just significant in the book, what they have to say. And then she said, behold, this is Naomi speaking, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. And so now, Naomi is going to turn up the heat on Ruth, right? Go home. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. I can just see young Ruth talking to her mother-in-law and saying, enough, no more. I am not listening. Do not tell me to go anymore. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord, Yahweh, do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. Ruth's first words come out with extraordinary strength, do they not? Of command and power of poetry. What do they sound like to me? I've read these verses my whole life. They're actually pretty famous. If you're around Christendom much, you might hear people make these statements. You know what they sound like to me? Wedding vows. They sound very, very much like wedding vows to me. She is vowing her complete and total loyalty to her mother-in-law. How would you like to do that, ladies? How would you like to just give all of your commitment to your mother-in-law? Your son is gone. I'm sticking with you. And I don't mean out of like spite. I mean like, you know, because you're responsible and you love her. Wow. This is powerful stuff. Ruth's words are faithful. They are adamant. She is remaining no matter what. She has vowed herself. And Naomi sees this, verse 18. When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. She didn't try to dissuade her. You've made your choice. I mean, Ruth has thrown in with Naomi. And now we see these two women on the road to Bethlehem. This is great. So they both went up, or they both went until they came to Bethlehem, verse 19. Don't miss. I mean, this story is so good. Don't miss that in history future, Joseph and Mary will take a journey and they will come to the same exact town. We sang about, you know, O little town of Bethlehem this morning. Isn't it amazing? I mean, this like speed bump on the map becomes the center of God's redemptive work. And we're going to see it right here in this story. It all connects. This is like the X-Files in the Bible. I mean, it's like crazy how stuff connects together. I love those kind of shows. I mean, I didn't actually watch X-Files, but I watched this show on TV called Fringe. I don't recommend it to anybody because it's gross. It's like always got like ooey-gooey alien stuff going on. But it is amazing how everything in the show connects. Like little stupid things connect to, and that's like the Bible. Stuff connects so much in the Bible. I promise you, if you'll hang out here for the next 4 weeks, you'll be blown away at what God does. Right down to the last couple verses. You should read this stuff. You really should. If you don't read your Bible during the week, you are missing out. It's really, really interesting. It's really good stuff. It's truly life-changing. So Naomi relents, and both women arrive in Bethlehem. And when they come in, the whole city is stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" Now, do you remember? She's from the Ross Morons, right? She's from the clan, that aristocratic clan, that wealthy clan that exists there in Bethlehem. And so they all know each other. It's like one of their own moved to Kansas and then came back. You moved to that evil flatland, and now you've come back to Rossmore. And so everybody says, "Is that Naomi? Is this her?" And she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi any longer. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." Mara means bitter in Hebrew. "For the Almighty," notice she doesn't even call him God Almighty. She just calls him Shaddai. El Shaddai means God the Almighty. Shaddai just means the Almighty. What does that mean? What does that little nuance mean? It means the one that is more powerful than I. He's got all the power. I have none of the power. And I'm mad about it. I get that. Have you ever felt that? Have you ever felt so totally powerless in the face of your circumstances? Have you ever felt totally powerless in the face of someone else's circumstances? Have you ever cried out to God, "Why can't you do anything? You're almighty and I'm not." And this is Naomi's cry. "In the face of the Almighty, you have dealt bitterly with me." And her bitterness towards God comes out. "I went out full," verse 21, "but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Since Yahweh has witnessed against me and the Almighty, the one with all the power, has afflicted me." Literally, has done evil. That word afflicted, literally, he has done evil to me. He has left me barren, bereft. She comes in and she feels, now that she's back in her family, the depth of pain and humiliation. We feel that bitter Naomi feels towards God. In a bit of foreshadowing, though, you know, like a good story writer, we get a little foreshadowing of what comes next. So Naomi returned, verse 22, and with her Ruth, I like that, with her Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now that would be really helpful. Like, that helps you, doesn't it? To know that it was the month of the barley harvest, right? I mean, we all know what that month is. Of course, it's late April, early May. She came back right before the barley harvest, which for the original reader would have made perfect sense because they were, you know, a lot of farmers and that kind of thing. But what we have is a woman that says, I have come back empty. I have come back bitter. The Almighty has reached his hand out against me and has stripped me barren of all that I have. But when did she come back? Just before the harvest. This is a story of how God has both emptied Naomi, but how he is going to give her a harvest that is unexpected. He is going to provide joy to her that you would not expect. What begins as bitterness in this book will progress into something that is joyful. It will progress into something that is full of life. There will be harvest that is coming, and it's not going to come through the means that Naomi has ever wished for. It's going to come from places that you would never, ever expect. And this is how our God works. As we sit here just 4 short weeks ahead of Christmas, and we begin this Advent season, and we anticipate the coming of Christ, as we anticipate the light of the world coming into the darkness, Emmanuel, God with us, as we anticipate all of these things, I want to invite you, as you have this morning, to walk with Ruth and Naomi, to walk back to Bethlehem, to come back to that little insignificant town and see what God will do. If you have circumstances that are difficult, and my friends, we do. I sat with a couple families yesterday that are just having real difficulty. And they're a part of our lives, yours and mine. We are a family together here. As we deal with the difficulties of those things, the circumstances that seem overwhelming, the loss of our own children, as we are in the midst of the teeth of those kinds of circumstances, will you walk through them with Ruth and Naomi and experience the joy and experience the harvest that God has? Because God promises that he will redeem. God takes every evil thing and makes it new. God reworks and renews. It's the great gift that he gives to us, that while we do not deserve him, he is right here, calling our names, calling us to him, and pleading with us to come back, to walk back. He beckons us back to him. Will you come during this season? As the worship team comes up this morning and closes our service, I would just encourage you to bring your own set of circumstances or the circumstances of someone else that is truly burdening your heart. I would just call on you this morning to bring those things to God, to bring them to God and to pour them out at his feet. Maybe it's for little Alyssa. Maybe it's for the Palamaki and May and Howe's family. Maybe it's for the Brearleys. Maybe it's for a situation I'm not even aware of that you are dealing with. But bring your deepest need, your greatest burden, the thing that threatens to make you bitter or has made you bitter, and bring it to the Lord and allow Him to minister to you this morning. Allow the harvest to pour in to the midst, those gaping holes of our lives. Let's stand and respond and worship Him together.